you know, I wanted to get in a little more on the ground floor so I could influence some of the decision making. You know, a lot of the people had shifted their focus during the early days of the environmental movement, and I was starting to feel like, yeah, there's a lot of things that are being overlooked that we should be training, educating our new engineers. Failure is an outcome of taking a risk, doing something that's a little beyond your comfort zone. And I never intended to fail, obviously, but I didn't want to have regrets later in my life. An example of how the approach to environmental problems changed, shifting the philosophy to bring in experts from across the country, ESF had talent and creative talent that could develop an innovative approach.
Thank you, and welcome to Campus Conversations, the podcast. I am Joni Mahoney, and I have the honor of serving as the president of SUNY ESF, and I've been enjoying a series of conversations with our esteemed faculty here about who they are and what kind of work they do here at the college. And today is my honor to welcome Doug Daly.
Thanks, Joni. Glad to be here.
And I've been looking forward to doing this with you because your path toward higher ed is a little different than some of the other faculty members that I've had the opportunity to interview. So why don't we just start out by just telling people a little bit about you?
Sure. And it was more than a little different. It was extremely different. I grew up in Central New York, and like many of our current engineering students, I was told by my high school guidance counselor, hey, you're good in math and science, and you should take a look at engineering programs. So I did that. And back in the day, I went through the SUNY application book that they had, and I just applied to every school that had engineering programs, and SUNY ESF was one of them. And to be quite honest, I had absolutely no idea what forest engineering was when I applied, but I was outdoorsy. And I said, yeah, I could see myself doing something in the forest, whatever that is.
It's interesting because you put all this thought into marketing and enticing students and, you know, going out and trying to encourage folks to enroll here. And then you hear something that simple, which is, I knew I was good at math and science and I was looking for an engineering program. And we labeled it forest engineering and the rest is history, right?
Yeah, there was in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of forest engineering programs in the United States and around the world. And through evolution, there are, as far as I know, no forest engineering programs left in the United States. They've evolved into like biological, agricultural engineering, or in our cases, environmental resources engineering. Not to give too much away, but, you know, I was a member of the last freshman class to enter ESF in 1978 before we went to a full transfer status institution for undergraduate. And the program evolved as the environmental movement evolved through the 70s and 80s. And I had, you know, the benefit of also staying for a master's degree in the environmental resources engineering graduate program. So I was able to modify my resume sufficiently to say that I had background in environmental engineering so that when I started looking for a professional career track, I didn't have to explain to every single person what forest engineering was.
Right, I would imagine. And you and I've had the opportunity to talk about this. You weren't actually building forests.
No, we weren't building forests. What I told people is basically it's civil engineering in the woods for the forest products industry. And so a lot of my background in that, in terms of water management, soils management, and the interaction of, you know, with the ecosystems was really grounded in what I learned here in forest engineering.
So you went straight through your master's.
I did. I was not astute enough to be aware that in 1982, I graduated in the midst of a recession. So I was out there banging the bushes to try to find jobs, but there weren't many to be had. And an opportunity came up to do the master's degree. I said, well, it's better to be an underpaid graduate student than an out-of-work engineer. So
I imagine, like a lot of people, you look back on that and think that was adversity at the moment, but I'm glad it went that way because it led to exactly where you are now.
And that's one of the things I continue to tell my engineering students is there's always opportunity. out there. You just have to be, in some cases, more patient than in other times. But that was the beauty of the engineering program for me, is that it gave me that foundation that I could choose my path after graduation. So, yeah, I finished the master's degree, focused a lot on water resources engineering. And then because of various circumstances, I ended up with a position as an intern for the city of Wichita, Kansas. Did that for a few months and then started working for the state of Kansas in Topeka as a water engineer in their Bureau of Water Protection. And we were developing policies and programs for wellhead protection strategies, where a municipality has a groundwater supply, and so you're looking at land use around those wellheads to make sure that you're protecting the groundwater quality.
Right, and I would imagine that experience has been very valuable to your current students because you have put an emphasis along the way on opportunities for your current students to network. You never know who you're going to meet or where you're going to land, and these professional relationships can pay dividends long down the road.
Those opportunities pay dividends in terms of tracking down your employer, but they also expose you to opportunities that you don't know even exist.
I just could not agree with that more. I never heard of most of the things that I interact with people now, you know, what they're doing. And I think you are so lucky that you found this path, but I guess it's not just luck. It's keeping your mind open to it. It's putting yourself in a position to seize an opportunity. And when the opportunity comes, you were pretty well educated. So
I don't think I could have said it better.
Okay, good. So then Kansas Water, what was next?
Well, fiance and I were both from Central New York, and so there was a desire to get back to the Northeast. There is water in Kansas. Most of it's underground, and the surface water bodies are a little too thick to drink and a little too thin to plow. So I started looking for a job in the Northeast. I ended up working at a consulting firm in the Buffalo area. And one of my first assignments was related to doing some analysis of sediments that had been collected from the sewer system around Love Canal. So I was looking at dioxin concentrations and transport. Yep.
Is that one of the first Superfund sites, right?
That is. Love Canal.
It was the first?
Yeah. And our first rental house was just a half a mile downstream from Love Canal. But then we ended up in the South Towns area. And from there, you know, things just took off because that was the mid 80s. There was more work than there were people to do the work. And a lot of my early work was in hazardous waste remediation and solid waste management, as well as slowly transitioning into some wastewater, mostly on the solids end. So most of my professional activities have been on the downstream end of society.
Well said. I have a lot more experience with that than you might guess, because in my previous role as county executive, charged with fixing our combined sewer system and preventing these overflows into our lake, I had a quick lesson in what it was the engineers like you were telling us needed to happen to make sure that we were protecting our waterways. So I could have had a conversation like this and understood what they were talking about with the combined sewer overflows that were designed and they open up. And when there's a big storm event or melt or whatever, they open up and, you know, by design, that combined sewer spills into the creek, which makes its way into the lake. But somebody had this bright idea that I should actually get in a canoe and get in the creek and go look at this for myself. So I did that and we started, I don't know, a mile and a half or so upstream and then headed toward the lake. And as you know, you go past more and more of these overflows, the quality of the water quickly deteriorates. And I waited until I was only probably 100 yards from the lake when I tipped my canoe and went into the water. And one of the first things I saw when I popped my head out was a photographer from the Post Standard. And I ended up with my picture. It was not pleasant. I called my husband. I said, I just fell in that creek that we have spent our entire life avoiding.
Yeah.
I just submerged.
Hopefully you kept your mouth closed.
Yeah, it was not pleasant. So I digress. And I just want you to know that
okay.
I know what you're talking about.
Because you went out on a limb as county executive. You implemented that green infrastructure program. program, Save the Rain. My students benefited from that because we worked with your consultants on a lot of real-world design experiences.
That benefit was mutual. I tell people all the time, Doug, when we went to the federal court to change that consent order and ask for permission to use green infrastructure, I wholeheartedly believe that the expertise that ESF was providing at the time was what convinced that judge to take a chance on us. And then I remember looking out my window on the 14th floor of the Civic Center and seeing ESF students on the roof of the convention center after we put the green roof on there. You know, ESF was deeply involved in that. And it was just unbelievable stroke of luck that this job was available when I left there. So then you went to Buffalo as a consultant. And then what brought you back to Syracuse?
There was an opportunity about 3 years in to my consulting experience to go to a small office in Rochester. Gave me a little more responsibility and authority, a lot more flexibility. And I did a lot of work with Monroe County on the solid waste side and on the wastewater biosolids management side of things. So a lot of classic environmental engineering work. Mm-hmm. But about 3 years into that experience, I started thinking that, you know, I was at a point in my career where I might be able to do something to, you know, give back a little bit. So I was already involved in professional societies, and I knew somebody who was developing the environmental health program or environmental waste management program at RIT. And I contacted John and said, hey, if you need an adjunct instructor for a course, let me know. So I ended up teaching for about 3 years at RIT in the evenings, a course in hazardous waste management. I had the expertise, there was demand, and it gave me a little variety in my life. But I also started to develop that kind of philosophy where I'd like to, you know, I wanted to get in a little more on the ground floor so I could influence some of the decision making. And I was starting to feel like, yeah, there's a lot of things that are being overlooked that we should be training, educating our new engineers.
You know, I never really thought about that, but it must be frustrating for you to be an expert and to be a consultant for a municipality and then take direction from people who aren't experts. And you kind of know, if I was in charge, you know, I would be making sure that this was happening or that was happening. And
so I had a very early lesson in that from our bureau director in Kansas, because we had spent a lot of time doing analysis of different policies and do this and do that and everything. And you know, evaluating things from feasibility and cost. And so we sent our recommendations up to the secretary of the department in a report, and we prioritized actions. And then the secretary made their decision, and it was kind of the inverse of what we had recommended.
Oh, nice.
And I was, one day I was in the office and I was like, what the heck? And my bureau director, who was also an engineer and awesome, sat me down and was like, look, we're engineers. We were told, do the engineering feasibility, look at all these things. We did our jobs. The secretary has their job, and they have to consider a lot of other factors besides what engineers say. And, you know, that opened my eyes a little bit more than they'd been, that there are other factors that are beyond the ken of just the engineers.
I think that's true, but I also think that there's a natural short-term vision of people that need to be elected. And a lot of the work that you're doing is really long-term. And so you get that push and pull from people who know outside the, you know, funny world of politics and election cycles, you would take this path. But the person who's making the decisions is like, I have constituents complaining about flooding and I need to do something quick. And,
right. You know. And I had a similar experience later on. We had a municipal/organization that built a landfill.
Okay, was not me.
And just the way things were going at that particular time, tipping fees were actually coming down back in the day. We did a quick pro forma analysis on it and said, well, the lowest cost option for you going forward in time is to not open the gates of the landfill. Yeah, you still have to pay off your bond, but don't open the gates. they open the gates, because politically you can't build something and tell people you're borrowing money and then say, oh, and by the way, we're not actually going to operate it. That's not politically good.
Right. No, I can totally imagine that scenario and trying to explain to voters why you have this bond that you have to pay off. And, you know, it's like you didn't know what you were doing, but really the truth is the market changed, right? Yeah.
And just to wrap that up, they've been successful.
Okay, good. Good. So then you must have discovered in that stint as a visiting adjunct faculty member that you like teaching, which I think teaching has got to be one of the most difficult jobs. I mean, you have to be on at that time all the time. And
it's a constant set of deadlines.
Yeah.
Regular deadlines.
It's a hard job.
And you have to produce on those deadlines, in my case, 3 times a week for a 3-credit class. In particular, my engineering students are constantly challenging me to stay on point, to stay on the game, and to keep challenging them along the way.
It's got to be exhausting.
Yeah, it is.
You must have liked it.
I do like it. I mean, that's the one part of the job that I think a lot of people have probably reflected on here, and I'll reinforce that it's exciting, and the challenge is something that I look forward to, because if I just got into a, you know, routine where I was doing the same thing all the time, I would have been looking for other places to express my creativity, but also to have an impact.
And that's the thing, the impact, because what you described as having drawn you to it was teaching the next generation. And it must be so satisfying to you at this point to see where some of your students have gone. So I want to just finish up the path here by asking you, you know, was this your first full-time faculty position here at ESF?
Yeah, first and only. It was fortuitous that one day I got a letter in the mail with a position description in it that said there was an opening here at ESF. And quite frankly, I was on a good career track. I didn't happen to be looking for a shift or anything. And I was like, yeah, okay, you know, faculty. But I had some really good things going on professionally. And we don't do that anymore. We don't send letters directly to alumni. We post things. And I think in those days, they tried to reach out. And I read the position description. It was, frankly, almost written for me. And my wife at the time encouraged me to apply. And I said, all right, I got nothing to lose by applying.
You've taken a lot of leaps of faith in your career path.
Yeah. But, you know, as you said earlier, the fact that I was developing professionally, that I started to do adjunct instruction, created an opportunity for me to even be considered for this position in the first place. And so I applied, got invited to an interview, and then experienced the classic academic decision-making process, which is, yeah, we'll let you know.
Sometime next year.
Well, I mean, in terms of academic decision making, it only took about 3 months. But at the same time, I was being heavily courted internally to transfer offices with a heavy promotion, big salary bump and expense account and everything to work on projects in Birmingham, Alabama, which had hundreds of millions of dollars of capital projects. And we were the exclusive engineer. I would have made the rest of my career building infrastructure for the city of Birmingham, Alabama.
Interesting. And, you know, you're in a position because you're a candidate for the job. You don't want to call and, you know, poke people and say, I need a decision, you know, but we are aware of that now. We're trying very hard to have a diverse pool of candidates. And, you know, like every institute of higher education, I think every company, everybody is cognizant of the value of diversity?
Yeah. So I took the position that was offered. I actually had several of my colleagues at the consulting firm say they were envious because I was doing something they'd always thought about doing. And I was also at a point where I had been looking at, you know, what are the formulas for success? And I realized that failure is a part of the formula for success.
Oh,
you learn from failure.
Absolutely.
And taking risks. So failure is an outcome of taking a risk, doing something that's a little beyond your comfort zone. And I never intended to fail. Obviously, I've been here 26 years, so I clearly haven't failed, but I didn't want to have regrets later in my life to say, what if I had done that? What if I had tried that? And I was supremely confident. I won't say overconfident, but I was supremely confident that if this didn't work out for me, there were other opportunities out there. And so I came at it with a, let's see what the first year brings, the second year brings, the third year. And I've done that 25 times.
That's great. And I know, again, that foundation that you had with the education that you got here at ESF, including your master's, and then all of that real world experience, it does give you a little bit of latitude to take those risks. Because as you said, you knew there would be opportunities. If you made this giant career change and you didn't like it for some reason, you had a lot of doors, I imagine, that you could walk through.
Yeah. And on the flip side, when I got here, I did things, you know, in my first few years that I had faculty members say to me, why are you doing that? I'm like, because I enjoy doing it and or somebody's got to do this. And they said, yeah, but, you know, you got to focus on getting tenure. And I was like, in my previous employment, I worked, you know, at the discretion of my boss and my tenure was 2 weeks. You know, it's like I'm taking not calculated risks, but I'm taking acceptable risks to do things because I think it contributes to the, you know, general community welfare, challenging students. I'm doing things and I continued to do things because I was told at the beginning, just keep doing what you're doing. You're doing great. And I'm like, okay, I'm doing great. I was told, bring the professional experience into the engineering program. Mm-hmm. That's what I did. It was not a conventional academic approach. But we're an engineering program. We are, you know, training professionals, educating professionals, and that's what I bring to the program.
And the proof's in the pudding with the recent success of your teams at WEFTEC. Why don't you tell people about what just happened in New Orleans?
Yeah, I've been advising the student chapter of the New York Water Environment Association for at least 12 years. I lose track of when I actually started doing it. Right. It may be more 14 years, but I work closely with the executive director, Patricia Zero Rehill. And the idea when I took over was it was going to be more than just a social organization that I was going to get students involved. I was involved as a graduate student, so I'm paying it forward. My mentor, my major professor, took me to an annual meeting in New York City in the middle of February in 1985. Never forget that particular experience. But And so, you know, I was paying it forward. It's a great organization. And I said to Patricia, I'm just going to take small steps, incremental growth and development. And for the last several years, the students are the ones that keep pushing to higher and higher levels. So this year, 13 students went to the national / international conference. There was about 18 to 19,000 people at this conference. Large exhibition hall and everything, technical sessions. And I had 13 students. The last 2 years, we went into double digits. Prior to that, you know, 4 to 6 students. And we started doing the student design competition 4 years ago. I thought I would never be able to put together a team to compete, but we started doing it 4 years ago. They've enjoyed the blast out of it. I mean, it's just such an uplifting experience for them. And this year, the popularity has grown. The state association had to actually have a competition to decide which two teams went. And as things turned out, we sent two teams from ESF, one in the water environment division and one in the wastewater division. And, you know, the euphemism, you got to keep pinching yourself. Like, is this really happening?
Yeah.
And of course, the students work hard to, you know, both raise funds, but because of their activities, they also are awarded travel stipends and grants from our local Central New York chapter. A lot of professionals who are also connected in some way to ESF. So yeah, we had two teams compete, and I think I finally figured out the formula for the water environment division. So one of the teams got second place out of, I think, maybe 10 or 12 competitors from across the United States. Big name schools too, big schools.
Yeah, in that phrase, we punch above our weight. ESF, this small specialized college in Central New York, is competing with these national programs.
And the other thing for me too is just to, you know, be clear that the New York Water Environment Association is about the water environment. It's not just about the engineering aspects. So this year we had students, you know, who were either supporting or participating in the design competition that were not strictly engineering students. So I say that to all those people out there listening, like the association has members that are policy oriented, legal oriented, basic sciences, ecologists. So anybody out there, any students listening that are in the water environment, there's a place for you in a professional association like that.
So how do you fit a robust research program into all that you're doing with the teaching and advising and traveling with students to win these competitions? What is your research program?
You know, that's evolved over time or shifted focus. You know, one of my big long-term projects started in 2003, working with Honeywell on the upland areas around Onondaga Lake, and working with their consultants, and we were doing proof of concept, which led to field demonstration of using short rotation woody crops, that is the willow biomass, as an alternative landfill cover system. So I was part of a team here at ESF that was interdisciplinary. I was responsible for the, you know, the water movement side of things. Tim Volk managed the willow side. Don Leopold was involved with, you know, wetland restoration. And so we were trying to integrate all of these pieces together and truly integrate them as opposed to standalone individual projects. You know, we started in the greenhouse with little teeny tiny pots. And within 3 years, we were planting on small scale plots on the settling basins. And then eventually, I think we've ended up with about 125 to 140 acres of willow.
I was actually up there on the shore when the machine came to put the willows in the ground. And I remember you could barely see them. They were just sticks.
Yeah, they're just little 10-inch cuttings that go in. And, you know, within 3 years, they're 20 feet tall.
I went back and it was amazing. And that is an engineered solution.
Yeah. And just to kind of show you an example of how the approach to environmental problems changed. When we went there in 2003, the gates were locked and it was virtually impossible prior to 2003 to gain access to those settling basins because they're under, you know, they were under regulatory oversight. And it was more like, let's not tell our story to anybody was the approach. And we went out there to the site and they literally handed us the key and said, go for it, go ahead. And, you know, I credit Honeywell, John McAuliffe in particular, with shifting the philosophy to, and you alluded to this earlier, bring in all the experts, that the experts just aren't resident within Honeywell, but bring in experts from across the country. And John recognized, I had known John for a number of years prior to that, that ESF had talent. That and creative talent that could develop an innovative approach.
You know, John McAuliffe is one of those people who you'll never see his name up on the billboard running for office and taking credit for all of this. But what happened out there at Onondaga Lake is due in large part to his willingness to do what you just said, open the gates and bring in the experts.
And the other shift was, you know, in our regulatory agency, our DEC, and Ken Lynch was an important part of embracing the innovativeness as opposed to just, no, we're not even going to consider doing this.
And as an attorney, I can tell you, it was just such a breath of fresh air to have the lawyer at the table. He wasn't acting as the lawyer. He was the Region 7
director.
But he is an attorney. And for him to have that can-do attitude was terrific. And just as an aside, ESF just honored Ken Lynch alongside Steve Breen at our annual Finestone Award. And so for people who are out on the lake and you see the DEC public boat launch and you see the name Ken Lynch on the boat launch, we've named it after him. Now you'll know who Doug's talking about.
Yeah, so the project involved a lot of cooperation and a lot of people who could see the vision further down the road. So I was involved in that for 12 years, 13 years, something like that. But and then in the meantime, other things were spinning up for me as well. So most recently, a little bit going back to my roots, no pun intended there, but I'm working with the DEC. My particular focus is to look at, you know, the feasibility of composting papers that are not otherwise marketable. So a lot of paper products don't actually go into your blue bin because there's no market for them. And then there's other papers that do go in the blue bin, but because of, you know, wet conditions, snowy conditions, or cross-contamination from broken glass, they don't end up being sold as paper. They end up in the waste stream. So a lot of these paper products are ending up in land disposal facilities across the state. And so DEC is interested in seeing if we can divert some of those paper products further up the waste management hierarchy, get them away from the landfills, and see if we can compost them for beneficial use.
And how's it going?
It's going. And so, you know, with all of these projects, you know, there's a research element in there. I've been able to fund graduate students, and same with this particular project. I've already put two master's students out on the streets that worked on the project. I currently have a PhD and a master's student working on the project. That's me, and that's my part of this kind of larger umbrella that's the Center for Sustainable Materials Management. And so a big chunk of the money is going into programs and that are focused on developing the markets for some of these materials, educating. So Recycle Right New York is now one of the products that the center is producing in cooperation with our partners at Syracuse University, the Center for Sustainable Community Solutions. And so there's a lot of policy programming that's going on that side. I've got the composting, and then Rom in our chemical engineering department, I hesitated there for a second, formerly paper engineering, bioprocess engineering. They're looking at making bioplastics from the fines recovered from the recycling, paper recycling process.
So two different raw materials.
Yes. Yeah. I'm taking literally trash. The raw material, not quite trash, but, you know, looking at things like wax coated corrugated cardboard,
things that are ending up now in a landfill.
Yeah. The underlying cardboard itself is, you know, recyclable many times over until the fibers break down so much that you limited use for
then
that
you send
particular
them to
product.
ROM.
Then you send them to ROM and make
bioplastics.
Yeah.
Yep.
But the wax coating basically prevents this wax coated cardboard from being recycled, and it ends up in the landfill. And that's a common product that we could potentially manage because there's points where, you know, like at orchards, you know, food service and retail grocery stores where it's a common waste product. And it's so it's sort of consolidated, you know, concentrated those areas.
You can take it out of the waste stream pretty easily.
Yeah. Yeah. So
what are those items? Like what is a wax coated corrugated
cardboard
that
box
I might
look
have?
Like?
Yeah. That I might have at my house. Like they're not pizza boxes.
No, pizza boxes are recyclable, but different counties have different programs that tell you, yes, put them in, or no, don't put them in your blue bin. You probably would not have wax coated corrugated at your house.
Oh,
but
okay.
If you go grocery shopping and you're in the produce section when they're unloading broccoli, for example, and you know the broccoli's packed with ice, so it keeps the cardboard from soaking up the water.
Is wax compostable?
Well, wax is fundamentally carbon as the primary element there, and our microbes and our fungi that are in composting systems feast on carbon. So the answer is yes. It has come in incidental with source separated food scraps and disappears, you know, in the, again, industrial scale, commercial scale, large composting facilities. And so we did this in small scale for my first two master's students to kind of sort of set the parameters. And then right now we started in August with a full-scale demonstration project with our partners over at Onondaga County Resource Recovery Agency. Yep, OCRA. and we stressed the system by putting 20 tons of wax-coated corrugated cardboard into one of their bays, blended it in, and we're tracking that for probably about 180 days by the time we get to the end.
That's cool. So when I saw you down at the Lafayette Station a couple of years ago, this was one of the smaller scale experiments?
No, the Lafayette Station is a different one.
Okay.
That's the stormwater one. And so kind of building off from a lot of what I learned from the Green Infrastructure Program, we got some funding from NYSERDA with DEC cooperation to see if we could improve the design specifications for biofiltration systems so that we could reliably remove nutrients from stormwater. So we do get removal of nutrients through filtration because those nutrients are part of the, you know, suspended matter that comes in as part of the stormwater. But about 50% of the nitrogen and phosphorus is in the aqueous form. So it pretty much passes through the system. So I was focused only on the aqueous side of things to see if we could come up with a filtration medium that, you know, would adsorb or absorb either the D or the B, the phosphorus and nitrogen in particular. And through repeated measures and repeated trials, we irrigated those columns over a period of 3 summers, generated thousands of samples to see if we could demonstrate that if you followed our spec, this is the performance for nitrogen and phosphorus removal that you could expect to see.
I'm very curious because it was a huge price tag for Onondaga County to get the phosphorus out. Were you able to find a medium that would have some effect?
Yeah, we're able to adsorb the phosphorus, and the heavy metals were able to adsorb that. There's a lot of other factors besides the soil medium that are affecting nitrogen transport through the columns.
You know, it's just so interesting, and everything that you're talking about, that we can see a real world application for that. And then you gather your students up and go demonstrate some of these real world applications. So,
And the hopeful outcome from that is that our work has been informing DEC as they rewrite their stormwater design manual.
And I'm sure it is. And people coming through here, students, faculty, are literally changing the world.
That's the impact that we hope for.
And that takes you back to the beginning of the story about why you dipped your toe in the visiting teacher role, was you wanted to have that impact.
Hard to measure sometimes, but having an impact, it's been a fun journey. And as long as it keeps being fun, I'll see what the next several years brings.
Well, I hope we can do this again and find out and see what you discovered about getting rid of nitrogen for us. So more to come on that. But thank you very much for taking time out of your day to talk to us and to tell us about the work you're doing here at ESF. You're one of the faculty here that, as I said, is literally changing the world.
Thanks. Glad I could share it with a little bit broader audience, too.
Okay, good. Nice to see you, Doug.
Nice to see you.